Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Lisa O'Halloran-Schwartz. She, during the fall, a group of indie booksellers whose taste I trust kept telling me, you must read What Could Be Saved. And I was like, really? This sounds so wonderful. And they were talking about this book. I actually went to a Simon & Schuster event and heard Lisa talk about the book. And I read it over the holidays and said, why didn't I read this sooner? I was completely captivated from page one, and I saw what had moved them as well. So Jodi Picoult calls this a harrowing tale of the lies of omission and the lies of commission that can break a family apart, and says it is a delicious hybrid of mystery, drama, and elegance, rich with detail, lush in language, and capable of keeping you on the edge of your seat. I couldn't have said it better. I agree, and I am so happy to hear that share that it's a Book Reporter Betson selection. It's one of our first of the year. I absolutely love this. So welcome, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by you telling us about What Could Be Saved. What Could Be Saved?
Well, it actually started as a short story when I was in medical school. I had just started writing fiction then. I'd always written poetry before then. And I wrote a story that was, it was short, and it was actually meant to be a nostalgic piece about the part of my childhood that was spent in Bangkok. And it was very sentimental, nostalgic. And I really loved that piece, but it wasn't really a story. And I kept thinking that it would be more or could be more over the years. And then decades later, I suddenly realized where it could go, and sat down and started writing what turned into What Could Be Saved, a whole book.
All of a sudden exploded in a different direction.
Here's a whole book.
You were born in Nigeria. You were raised in Bangkok. And what was it like growing up there? Like, how many years were you there?
We weren't there that long, but it was most of my life at the time. But we spent a little sliver of time in Pittsburgh in between the two. So I got to know what snow was, which was great for the future. And by the time I came back, I was ready for primary school.
Okay.
So we were there probably 3 years total. And it really made a mark on us because we loved it there so much. Now, this book, it's not about people who loved being there for the most part. And that is so opposite of our experience. So we just loved Bangkok. And my parents went back every year. Wow. It was a major part of our lives. It's a beautiful culture. Not that I really understood or understand the culture, but what I can see is it's lovely.
So when you were there, did you travel a lot around Thailand, or were you just in the city?
We were pretty typical expats in that my mother traveled all over the place by herself. You could do that. It was incredibly liberating, I think, for her, because she went from being sort of an American housewife to free as a bird out in the world. They went to Burma. I mean, she was just out with her other sort of the company wives. She was just out there. Right. So she had a great time. We went to very typical places like Pattaya Beach was actually a family resort. Now it's, I think, a bit of a lurid place, but it was a quiet little family resort. I have sweet photographs of an undeveloped strip of sand that is now just blocked with high rises. And, you know, and we went to Hong Kong and the same thing. The change is, I mean, yes, it's been a long time.
Right.
The change is spectacular. It really is.
So at the heart of this is a story about siblings. You have a sister and you have a brother, just like Laura in the book. You lived abroad. Was this something you always wanted to write about? You did the short story, but it clearly had an impact on your life, even those 3 years when you were young. So had you always thought about going back and visiting this, or was it something that I'll deal with the short story and we'll see?
You know, I don't write with any idea of what I'm doing. I can't explain it, but I write almost as though I'm possessed. So the characters are, they do what they're going to do. They say what they're going to do. No, they say what they're going to say. No, it's very inefficient. Mm-hmm. So I end up learning as I go. I was so excited when it turned into a sibling book. It wasn't intended to. Oh, all along, in every sort of incarnation of this, as it's tried to become a book, I had the siblings when they were young. And the real changeover when I actually wrote this, what turned into What Could Be Saved, was the structural change of splitting it, making it a dual timeline book, which wasn't intended in the past, and having one of the children go missing. Mm-hmm. So at that point, the adult children became important, and the young children also became important in a way they hadn't been before. But I always loved writing them.
Yeah. I love when they're being chauffeur driven around and they're sitting in the back seat squabbling on their way to ballet lessons or swimming or wherever they're going. He wants to go do, you know, taekwondo, all these kinds of things. And it's like they're typical children in a lot of ways, even in this foreign environment where they have a driver, they have people taking them places. And, you know, when they first went, they were only planning to go for a year. I love this. And the mother, as a result, packed clothes for them to go home that were one size larger. And I always remember that when we were little, because if your mom was buying you something on sale, she was buying the next size, like you can wear this next year. Like whether you're going to like it or not, you're going to wear that next year. And so there's this whole plan that the family had of this is what we're going to do a year abroad. The plan gets upended. I think they were there 3 years or a little bit more. Well, and their lives just get completely shifted around as time goes on. When you went, did you know you were going to be there for just those 3 years, or was it the same thing? It went for one and then expanded.
Did I have any idea what in the world was going on? I went where they told me. I sat where they told me. I didn't know. I didn't know. They told me we're going back to America. I said, great. They said, we're going to, you know, wherever. That's fine. So yeah, I didn't, that wasn't part of our story. That came along. I think I might have nicked that from the Poisonwood Bible, because I read that book a long time ago when it came out, but I loved that book. And I'm sure that little detail stayed with me. Mm-hmm. If you remember in the Poisonwood Bible at the beginning, they thought they'd be there for a year, and it was so touching, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that I realized later when someone mentioned that this was like the Poisonwood Bible, I thought, oh, I bet that's where I got that idea.
That's where that little kernel was of what was going on. So you opened the book in 2019. Why 2019? Because we're going to go back to the 70s. What was the pivotal point? Was that where you were writing at that point? Or was it just everybody would have developed their lives so much by 2019?
Well, I wanted to make it as current as possible before COVID. Mm-hmm. When I was
what
writing
an idea.
Right. When I was writing it, COVID was not a thing. And I pulled it. It was originally 2018. There's my dog. It was originally 2018, but it turned into 2019 because I wanted to pull it up to as close as we could be. I just feel like it's more immediate that way. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if it had been 2018, it would have felt random. But I would have made it 2020 if there hadn't been COVID.
Yeah. And it just changed the whole world. It would have changed the whole book. You would have had a lot more. They would have gone any place.
In some ways that I knew, I'd already figured out that was a thing when I was revising, because it was just a distant rumble on the horizon in my emergency medicine doctor groups on Facebook that I'm in touch with. I was hearing about it from other parts of the world, and I thought, you know, I just think it's going to be a thing, and I better not, I better keep that in mind.
When were you first hearing about it? Was the end of 2019?
Yeah, or like December, January.
Yeah. And how everything changed like in an instant. I mean, how everything, it's interesting because I saw the note the other day that they're thinking they're going to have the Summer Olympics this summer. And I was like, okay, wait a second. Are you living in a different universe from me? And somebody said, well, yes, they're thinking of vaccinating all the athletes. And I was like, and how about the coaches, the spectators? Like there's a lot more people involved. So it seems like we're still trapped in, well, we can still do, but it's just the world has been completely upended. But meanwhile, you're going to flash us back then to the early 70s. And so we've got Robert and Genevieve. They've moved with their young family to Thailand. Robert works and was supposed to be a one-year project and building a dam. And I really like that, you know, there was this detail. But is Robert really building the dam? And I'm not going to give anything away in this book because there's so much for the reader to discover, because it's like the peeling an onion apart. Because as you're reading, you're learning different things that will come back later on, but also then the onion's going to keep peeling as it goes on as well. And that's what I just loved. So when we meet the family, they're already there 3 years. And I love that she's in charge of entertaining, which is a full-time job, being the wife of the executive. And she feels very put upon with all this entertaining and managing the children. But in some ways, she has this really wonderful life. And it was this really like the narrative of what a wife would have been living like in Bangkok at the time? Is this what they would have been doing, is sort of running the family and running the entertainment?
Oh, absolutely. But Genevieve didn't resent that part of it. She didn't mind throwing parties. That was actually what she wanted to be doing in Washington, D.C. She didn't want to be doing it in Bangkok. It's so hard, at least back then. It's really hard. You know, the utilities are fitful, or they were. The availability of things, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to make this dish. You had to hope that the markets had it, you know, on and on. And so yes, this was very typical, but the attitude of Genevieve was the opposite of my mother's attitude. Genevieve's attitude was she wanted to create her own home in Washington, D.C. She wanted to sort of recreate it as much as possible in Bangkok. Mm-hmm. And my mother was really the opposite. She's very interested in the culture and very interested in what was going on. But yes, parties were kind of the thing you had to do because it was fun. And that maybe the Thai culture got to them too, because there's a real emphasis on fun and enjoying yourself. And so parties happened. It was also easier probably to throw them because you had a household staff.
Exactly. You had, was a person A, B, and C, these, you know, one, two, and three were helping you out with everything. Tell us about the hierarchy of that, because I found that so interesting as well. You've got, and if your number one is not great, it's not going to be great for you.
The number one is in charge of the household. I mean, I think of like Downton Abbey and that butler. I mean, he ran the staff. Well, our number one was like that. And she was in charge. She was in charge of things that I think we wouldn't have been able to do. She was, you know, behind the scenes doing a lot of things to make sure our household ran smoothly. And then there was the number two and the number three. And the kind of, as the numbers go down, go up, the tasks kind of go down. So the youngest, the number three, she really was pretty young. Mm-hmm. She wasn't as young as the one in the book, but that doesn't mean that there weren't plenty of 12 and 13 year olds working in service.
And I like that they had American names because nobody could speak their Thai names. So it was like, yes, well, we're going to call her Nancy, or we're going to call her whatever, just so that it's easier for us.
Well, my family, my mother would never, ever, ever have done that. Genevieve did that. And I found it, I don't know why it just happened as I was writing, but it just made sense. Mm-hmm. Because she was just trying so hard to make this a normal environment, one that she understood. She was really unhappy that her life had been taken from her. She liked her life. Mm-hmm. She liked the life she was going to have in America, you know, just like her mother's life. She didn't want anything more than that. She wanted just like her mother's life. So she was not going to have a servant named, you know, Deng. That's just not going to happen. She would have to be Harriet. I mean, it was, so I thought that was really, I found it really funny. But it's also, I mean, it's quite terrible that somebody would rename somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Make it better for them, make it easier for them to remember, and it make they feel like more like Washington. Like, this is the way it would be. Just,
you know, we don't have the strange, difficult to pronounce names. Now, the thing that I hope was noticeable, though, was that the children called the servants by their Thai names.
Yes.
And I liked the fact that the children, just as you said, are like children anywhere. Mm-hmm. They're in a strange environment. They don't know it's strange. It's not really all that strange, except for the fact that they don't really belong there. And for them, the Thai names are no problem. They don't think they're weird. And so they just use them, but they know not to use them in front of their mother.
Yeah. There are a lot of things that are happening that they know not to do in front of their mother. They're typical children, you know, conspiring at the same time. And something happens very early in the book with the family driver that changes really the whole trajectory of these families' lives. There's this one moment, which I'm not giving away, that happens. And at that moment, it looks like it's a small thing. It looks like it's just a tiny thing that happens, a detail. And then later on, when I was projecting, is if that didn't happen, so much else would never have happened in this story to each of the members of the family. And I think that we often can look at one instant where everything flips or everything changes. But for this, it was something so subliminal. Was that always there? Or did you go back as you had the rest of the story and make that part of it?
That's such a good question. The short story was called The Driver when I first wrote it, because it was an incident that I remembered from my youth and very fragmentary. So of course I made it into a story. And then as I wrote this book that sort of bloomed out of it and bloomed around it, I realized that that piece absolutely had to be pivotal. Mm-hmm. And at one point in the book, someone is looking back, if you, I'm sure you remember, someone is looking back and trying to figure out where it all started, where the problem started. And there are a lot of different places you can choose, mm-hmm. but I think the reader will probably choose that one, as you say, exactly as you say, small incident that really shouldn't matter and shouldn't have had any consequences. But I will say that all the other things that happened were necessary too.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. You're right, like that one was the one that started it all. And I thought that was satisfying for a reader. I love a story that kind of ties everything up and makes the world seem neat, because it's not.
Mm-mm. No, it's not. It's even when she's, you know, the story opens, he's saying to her, we're having this dinner party. We want to bring another guest. It's going to upset the apple cart. So things are kind of unraveling right from the beginning. The children are not behaving exactly the way they're supposed to behave, but those are nuances. Those are nuances. And then you've got this other little nuance with the driver, but that one sort of spins their whole world a different way. And I just found it was so interesting, because you almost reflect back on it later. And as I was going through and I, you know, folded down pages, I actually read a very early copy of this book when I went to go read it, because I didn't want to mess up the very pretty one that's behind me. And I went down and I folded down that page. So obviously when I was reading, I realized that was going to mean something, but I wasn't sure what. So it was, you know, quite wonderful. You know, when they first live in Thailand, there are all these little details that are coming up that there are things that the children are assimilating, the thing that children want to be. They're going to school with other children like them, but they still have a lot of things that are going on of somebody's bullying, somebody's doing this, somebody's doing that. It just shows that no matter where children are, things can end up being the same way. And the boy feels like a little bit of an outsider with his sisters. At the same time, he's not the girl that's going and doing these things. And he's trying to stand up for himself all the time. His dad's not exactly like bonding with him as well. He's sort of like a really loner. So that when you find out that something happens to him along the way, you're almost seeing like the setup of what it was. But it's so interesting, because when the book starts, and we can say this part because it's really at the beginning, his sister is getting a call saying, I think I know where your brother is. And it's all these years later. And she doesn't think that this is something, Laura, the one sister, doesn't think that this is something strange. She really thinks that this is her brother. And her sister B is like, oh, they're just trying to get money out of us. They're just trying to extort us or whatever. Did Laura have a different bond with her brother that would make her sit there and say, or why would Laura sit there and say, yeah, I think I got to go deal with this?
I think that's such a good question. Laura was actually very bonded to Philip, but she barely remembers it. And that was part of the book's treatment of things that happened in our childhood or our youth. We may not remember them very clearly, but they were important. And so the children have these whole lives, and they will, you know, Laura barely remembers any of this in the present day in the book. But it was important then, and I would argue it's important now. You know, it's important forever in their lives. And she and her brother were very close in age, 15 months apart, and the older sister was, you know, 5 years older. So they really were the two together. And at one point, the older sister says she sort of remembers that she thinks of them almost like having twin brother and sister, because they're always together, they're always playing. And so Laura does, she is more susceptible to this contact. At the same time, there's another part of it that Laura is the baby of the family. Now, she's in her 50s now, mm-hmm. but she is still the baby of the family. Mm-hmm. She's been treated that way her whole life in some way. B has really taken a lot of the responsibility away from her. And I thought I wanted that to be obvious, because I really think that family constellations stay mm-hmm. your whole life. You know, it doesn't really matter. My sister is my big sister forever. And Laura has never had to deal with all the people, all the leads and the fakes and the people trying to contact. It was always their mother and the older sister, Beatrice, who dealt with all of the, you know, scams or all the leads they would get that never turned into anything when they were trying to find him. And so Laura's never had to deal with it. So to her, it's not old news. It's not unusual, but I mean, it's not usual. And she's been contacted by just because of a fluke, because she's the only one who's really online with her maiden name. Mm-hmm. So that's why.
And they're going to go track him down. And she says, yes, I'm going to go. And her sister's, I don't know if this is a good idea. And when she goes, and what she ends up finding, and finding him. And that is just such a moment of, you've got somebody whose entire childhood was erased. It's like where you grew up, they were on like two different planes. And they started like back here and then totally different places. And what are you going to learn about what happened to him? And what aren't you? And what's the reader going to know before they know? And I just thought you did such a beautiful job of putting that all together. In fact, there's this really great line that you have. It's guilt is like a coiling snake with a tail in its mouth. No beginning and no end. And there are gems like that throughout the book. They're just gems, because people are, you see that and you can see what's ending up happening, but it's a brilliant way to sit there and talk about what was really going on in this family, what was really going on with this whole connection of what was happening. So do lines like that just flow from you?
Well, that is the point of writing for me. It's not really the ultimate point of writing, but that's the joy, the unbelievable joy. When something comes out right, it's fabulous. And then you spend afterward, you have to revise and revise and revise and decide what beautiful gem doesn't actually serve the story and you have to part with it. Yeah. But I did love that. I love that whole chapter. Mm-hmm. That's Robert's chapter. And he's so dear. All the characters are so dear to me, really. But I was concerned, actually, when Atria acquired the book, that my editor, the delightful Peter Borland, was going to tell me that I would need to cut that chapter. And instead he did not tell me that. He loved that chapter. And that made me feel like my book was in good hands, because it really, that chapter is really important to me. It does provide an overview on what's happened in this family. It also, to some extent, gives some reflection of the fact that they were in such an odd time in the country, the history of this country. Mm-hmm. You know, they were away in their expatriate bubble during the real uprising in America that changed everything, you know, mm-hmm. in my lifetime. And I wasn't here for it. Mm-hmm. But people have told me that it went from 1968, and then in the fall of 1968, everything just became bedlam. Everyone was, you know, they went from coats and ties in freshman year of college to, you know, cutoffs and bare chests in the dining hall. And I think that's that kind of change and unrest and upheaval. I wanted to have a moment with Robert when he is reviewing things, the situation, that would reflect some of that, mm-hmm. some of the bigger situation, and not just the specifics of the family.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, because Robert is a kind of a quiet character in the book in a lot of ways. He's the father of the family, but he's got some quirks, which I want to get into, that, you know, you wrote into his, he's got little nuances, things that he has to do, perform, certain things have to happen a certain way with him, little mannerism and tics almost of what's going on. And at the same time, he's not who his wife actually thinks he is. And there's a lot going on there that's hidden from the family, hidden from everybody, a hidden life in a lot of ways. And so as a result, he's like an imposter in his life, but in his family, he's not. Is that making sense? It's like he's the imposter out there, but at home, he actually, when he comes home and he sheds his overcoat or he takes off his suit jacket and he becomes dad in the family, it's a very different person than who he is out there.
Yes, I think it becomes more different after the central event of the book when, you know, Philip disappears. He changes. And I think he's just bumbling along. He bumbles along. He's classically, you know, not to use cliched phrases, but he's a little bit of the white man failing upward, mm-hmm. where he really can't, it's 1960s when he gets this job he's in. He doesn't really have to worry about it. He doesn't have to worry about money. So he just goes on a whim. You know, it's really a whim that carries them to Bangkok. And then he really isn't planning, a little bit the way I wrote this book. He's planning everything and he doesn't really know what's going to happen. But then he becomes much more of a deliberate person. He's forced to become more of a deliberate person and more engaged with his actual life. I think he would have benefited from living in this time. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been very open to shedding that requirement to be so masculine and so macho that it really dogged him. He really didn't, might have been able to pick up from the part where he thinks about his life at school had been really difficult until he became good at that athletics, until mm-hmm. he grew and became athletic. And that saved him from the teasing and taunting of other boys. And I'm sure it's still true, but there was such a pressure on young men to be a certain way, mm-hmm. just as there was on women to be a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I think both Robert and Genevieve were in their little corners. Genevieve liked her corner, though. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. I think Robert really would have been happier in a different time. And I'm a big fan of him. I wish he'd had a different chance,
a different opportunity. Well, you know, I also did like when she reigned over the new women who were coming into the country, and they would have these meetings about the things that people had to be worried about. Now, personally, I would have sat through one of those meetings and packed my bags and gone home, because it was things about the water. I think it was going to be the water, the snakes, the dysentery, like all the things that could happen, and the water could turn off in the middle of a party, and then what are you going to do? And these are the places. Now, if I was one of these young women who would come with her children, I would have said, first plane out. Like, I do not want to be here. But these women are all, like, obviously speaking to these new people who are coming into the country and saying, let me just tell you what it's going to be like here. And they're just, and I thought those moments of camaraderie, but yet it was also some back and forth with those women of, who's one-upping, who has got who coming to their parties, who has got the best whatever. And her being known as a great party planner was something that her husband absolutely loved, and that she was special and she was whatever. And she didn't want to really give up that kingpin kind of a thing. So when she was sitting talking to these women, I thought she was making it seem so horrific of what they were going to have to be and deal with, you know?
Oh. I think she was literally just trying to help them
lay it out.
She was someone who was always in charge. Mm-hmm. And she was so capable, like her daughter Beatrice eventually becomes so capable, just so naturally. She was a natural leader. So she naturally just took everything in hand, because when she arrived, she did. I mean, there's a whole section. There are many sections of this book that are not in the book. And there's a whole section of her first day there where she just does no idea what's happening. And another woman, an expat who's been there for years, takes her on and takes her under her wing and teaches her. And she realizes that, you know, she needs to help. So it really is it's a good impulse that makes her conduct these meetings with the new wives who come in every...
Yeah.
While it's so, I mean, people are funny. And I think the women in these groups, they all have their own personalities, and they're starting to go rogue because it's at home, everybody's things have changed. People are not buttoned up and prim. And so they're showing up wearing pants. I mean, she's just horrified that somebody's wearing pants. It just seems really funny now. But I know that Genevieve, the person I created, although she feels like she lives outside me, you know, because she's in this book now. But she was just, she really wanted things to stay the same way. And she wanted to help these people. She would never have taken the tactic of saying, you know, welcome to Bangkok. Here are these wonderful cultural things, and you know, you can enjoy, go explore. She would have said, you know, she was busy saying, this is how you do your laundry, this is right, do your shopping, because she was trying to help them stay alive. I think people like Genevieve don't realize that you really can take from your environment and meld into your environment instead of deform your environment to make it just like your home.
Yeah. Yeah. And your number one is going to be very important. Whoever you have as your number one is going to be the person that runs your house. And if they're not there for you, your whole thing's going to fall apart. And you just picture this person there for the first time going, oh my gosh, you know, like what would have happened? What would have happened? You know, first plane home, what time's the flight?
I think a lot of these women, I mean, I actually respect these women who, and they're like military wives. Mm-hmm. They're very much like military wives. Military wives are just told, pick up and move, and here's a new spot, and good luck figuring it all out. It might even be a new country. It might be a whole new culture, new language. You know, just a new city in America you've never been to. You know, good luck, husband's going to work, and you have to figure it all out.
Right.
And these women take their roles really seriously. They are like military wives in mm-hmm. that. And I love them. I respect them.
Yeah. And I really love the story because it's also the family at the same time. She's also trying to be nurturing towards her children and give them wonderful experiences. And I can't imagine what it was like for her getting on the plane to leave Thailand and assuming she left her son behind. I mean, I can't even picture that moment of walking up the steps on the plane and just saying, okay, we're going to leave here now. And not knowing all those years and what it must have done to her not knowing that whole time of what was going on. And it changes her life in a very dramatic way of who she becomes and where she goes from there. Was there always the missing child, like right from the beginning when you were writing? Was that always part of the book?
It was always part of this incarnation of the book. I made a lot of false starts that I didn't understand. You know, I always want the reader to really enjoy the book because I'm a reader first. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I was aware that a lot of what I was writing, it might sound pretty and it might be profound in places, but it wasn't carrying you forward with a plot. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, my old teacher, Richard Bausch, used to say, you know, why have you disturbed the peace by starting this story? Like, there has to be a reason why you're telling this story. It's not, and I thought, well, I'm serving myself in some very nostalgic way, but there needs to be more. And mm-hmm. that's where, when I realized suddenly, I had, you know, scenes and chapters, and when I realized suddenly that one of the children needed to disappear, it absolutely crystallized the book. And then I understood that his disappearance changed it from this dalliance and this kind of, you know, it could be sort of silly or to something, you know, it crystallized all the dangers that they were facing and the dangers sort of in the world. So I really, and I also thought if I were reading this book, I'd want to know all about that. Because mm-hmm. when I'm writing a book, when I'm trying to, I think, would I care? I mean, I don't think you have to argue that this point, this very central point, is the man who returned Philip and what happened to Philip in 1972.
Yes.
You want to know. And I love a book that has a real urgent question to it.
Yeah, because you're looking at what happened to him and you're going to find out all these little pieces about through the years, but the way your storytelling is with it, we see it from different perspectives. We're seeing his perspective, what he went through, how they were looking for him, what Genevieve's reaction is, what Robert's reaction is, how the siblings feel. I just, to the readers, I just can't tell you how much I really totally enjoyed this book as I was reading. And it was funny because I was thinking of people that I thought would enjoy the book. And one of them I thought was, I should reach out to Lisa C. because I thought Lisa would really like this book because it's about family and culture and a different world and the way the whole thing comes apart. And then I saw when I finished that she had read it and she blurbed it. And I love moments like this. I mean, I just love moments where I'm like, wait a second, I said that person would like it. And she obviously read it and loved it. Well, you had two previous works. You have two previous books. When you were writing those, did you feel the same way that you felt when you were writing this one? Or did you realize in this one, I'm changing my writing to a whole different level. I'm going to a different direction.
That's such a great question. The first book, I think, was just trying to figure out how to write a book. That was when I was in medical school, and I really had just written poetry until then. And so I was just trying to figure out, how do you write a book? And, you know, I read it. I kind of like that book. It's fun to read. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problems with it. But I feel like each book gets more, it sounds a little conceited, but I think each book achieves more on different levels. Mm-hmm. I really was very, very proud of The Possible World. And I worked on that a long time and very hard. And I feel really, really good about the language in The Possible World and the story and the way that, I mean, readers have told me they feel so much when they read it, and that's great. Mm-hmm. This book I feel is a whole new level. Mm-hmm. Because in The Possible World, there are three characters. And this one, and that's not always an argument that's better, but this one, I really think you get to know six people at least very well. Mm-hmm. And in very difficult circumstances, very complex, and there are a lot of threads. So yeah, I feel like this is a new level, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to pull this off, frankly, because it was hard. I mean, I was there was so much, and I'm a poet at heart. And so for me, like 40 words is a lot. So anyway, I feel very proud of it.
Really, yeah, do. And it was a lot. But you were also into each person in the family's head, because you're seeing it from her perspective. You're seeing Genevieve and what happens with her that's a little bit outside the norm of her marriage in Thailand, something that you might not have expected, and what the ramifications of that were on the whole family as a result of this one choice that she's made. And you see how each person of what they're doing and what's happening has a different effect on what's happening. And I just love that. I just want you to know that I'm very much like Laura in one way, that we both don't know how to make coffee. So I found that was very amusing. And she's someplace and the men say, you make the coffee. And she says, I don't know how to. And I was like, yes, Laura, I'm the same person. I have no idea how to make coffee. Which character was you two?
I never drank coffee. I always drank just tea. I drink tea.
Well, I had an author come here for coffee that people who have listened to the author series will have heard this story before. And she said, oh, I'm going to stop by for coffee. And I said to my husband, can you make the coffee in advance? And he said, I'll have it all lined up. You'll just hit the button, because I had no idea what to do. It was very, very, very funny.
True. My sister taught me how to make coffee in a very
methodical way.
She really loves it. And so she taught me how.
Okay. Which character was your favorite to write? Was there one?
I would say all of the children.
Okay.
When the children are small, I love the relationship between them. They fight and they argue and they jockey for position, and but they love each other, and they're the closest to each other that everyone can be. Your DNA is the closest to your sibling. There's nobody else who has the DNA as close to yours. And I really think, if it's a birth sibling, and I really think that these children they're tangled in the same web. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I guess it's partly the nostalgia of it, but I just love that children, they're so innocent, the way they fight with each other and the way they have to have rigid, very turn, they have to take their turns about everything.
Yes. Who sat in the front seat? She sat in the front seat before. You can't sit in the front. Oh, there were all those little, I only have one sister, and I was still like, you know, who goes where and who goes what? And it was two choices. And right. Times that, like, I thought your favorite character might've been Laura for some reason. I don't just thought it was Laura. And I just thought that you did, because Laura's, she's sort of outside. She's not the oldest. She's not the middle. She's not the one that disappears. She's not the one that's a boss and in charge. She's not the one, she's all these different things. So that was just my feeling about her. Now, the interesting thing is until I read to the end, I didn't realize that A, you had a sister, and B, I know your sister. Your sister is another writer, Carla Buckley. And at the end of the book, I'm reading the author's notes and I see, and I like, you know, I want to thank my sister, Carla Buckley. And I'm like, Carla Buckley? And then I pulled up, because I've known Carla for years, and I put two pictures and I was like, yep, they're definitely sisters. Yeah. So at what point did she read the book? Like, do you get far along and then had her take a look, or where was it?
Well, we live near each other. Mm-hmm. And we talk about writing like 90% of the time. And so she saw pieces of this all the way along. I mean, she sat across from me in the coffee shop. She's writing, I'm writing. And so it's hard because I don't even know if she'll read the final book. She's read and she's heard about it. I mean, she may not have read every piece because I really don't share the work too much. But I would talk about, you know, problems I was having. Like, I'm trying to make this happen. I'm trying to find a way that this can happen. And she'll troubleshoot with me. I do it with her too. We're incredible. I mean, I feel incredibly lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of months ago, I interviewed Rose Carlisle, who'd written a thriller. She's from New Zealand. And she was saying that she and her sister came up with the plot at lunch. And her sister goes, "Well, you go write it." And the two of them were constantly going back and forth. And it was just fun to hear that that's the kind of thing that you're both writers and you can share that kind of an experience. Because writing is kind of lonely. I mean, it's really lonely. You're writing with a group of characters, but it's you in a room. So you across the table in a coffee shop is a good thing. Also, I heard that she really liked the birthday cake you made her the other day. I saw that too.
Yeah, you know, I bake for fun. But yeah, I miss that coffee shop. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a routine. I would go there every morning and it was the only way I got any peace. My dog otherwise would harass me all day to pet her or walk her. So I would walk her in the morning and get to the coffee shop, first person there, and sit and write for four uninterrupted hours.
Wow. Wow.
So my whole life, you know, became, you know, all the stuff that you have to do crashes in. But yeah, those are really good days. And I'm hoping that we have them again.
Yeah. Yep. Sooner or later. So you became a doctor before you were a writer. I always love this. Like, you know, the night we were doing the Simon Schuster event, they said, well, she was a doctor. So what did you practice? What drew you to medicine and what did you practice?
Emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. I started out as a neurologist actually. And I got halfway through that residency and realized that really wasn't taking me where I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. I was interested in medicine I just thought it'd be interesting and difficult, and I need something interesting and difficult or I would get bored. And I also thought it was a way to give back to the world in a way, or to do something useful. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of things are really useful. I think writing is less useful than all these things that people do to keep the rest of the world going. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, I've had a lot of luck in my life, and I think I would be good at diagnosis. I ended up being pretty good at diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But doctoring is so much more than that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I did the neurologic diagnosis. And then I realized I wasn't really the kind of person who wanted to end up in an office wearing like little shoes with like heels on them. Mm-hmm. I was much more the kind of person who would be in a pair of scrubs, you know, with blood everywhere. That just seemed like much more my type of thing with, you know, comfortable shoes. I think that was pretty important. Mm-hmm. So I switched to emergency medicine and I practiced that for a couple of decades.
Well, you know, it's interesting because people said to me, like, you know, what would you do if you weren't doing this job? And I said, oh, I think there are three jobs I'd like to do. Triage in an emergency room, landing planes in air traffic control, but it has to be at LaGuardia on a Friday afternoon in the summer with a thunderstorm. Like, really, let's up the challenge. And what was the third one? Programming the NFL, like programming, like moving those things around. Because I think it's that immediacy of you have to make a decision. You have to make a decision about what to do. And, you know, I think that when you're writing, you have so much more latitude of where you can move the characters and what you can do. Whereas when you're in that emergency room, somebody comes in and they're bleeding and you've got to figure it out like right away. This is what's going to happen. This is where to go. So
it's a good and bad thing. I think emergency medicine, there are protocols. You are trained. You can resuscitate somebody without having any idea what the actual cause is. You can be figuring that out as you're saving them. So there's a real sort of exoskeleton that supports everything you do. And writing is, you're right, it's just a gelatinous blob of anything can happen, good luck. Mm-hmm. But I'm very impressed that you mentioned air traffic control, because I always use that as the example of what I would not be good at, what I could never do. So I think you probably clearly have a very good right brain.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this, let's get from here to here. Let's just go from here to here. Yeah.
I think it's somebody, an air traffic controller has to have very good spatial in their head, has to think of all these different things, and the multitasking has to be phenomenal.
Yeah. So, kudos. Yeah. Well, no, it's fun because sometimes my son will come up, we work together, and he'll come up and he'll look at my computer and he's like, how can you have all those windows open? How can you have? And I said, because if I don't want to do this, I'll do that. If I don't want to do this, I'll do that. But it was, so you were writing poetry at the same time you were a doctor. So you were you publishing the poetry or writing for your own joy?
I'd written poetry since I was a child, very, very young. And it was just something I did. It was very private. I think I might have sent a couple away to magazine at some point, but without much great hope, and they weren't taken. But there was just something that within me that always knew I was going to find my way to write. I didn't think I had anything important or new to say mm-hmm. when I was in my 20s and I started writing. And I just felt that I was, I did have the opportunity to quit medicine and go to get an MFA. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I just wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to do that. I didn't feel like I knew enough yet. And so while I was doing medicine and, you know, practicing, and you can't really do a lot of anything else when you're doing medicine. Mm-mm. And I was reading a lot mm-hmm. all the time. I always felt guilty. I used to envy my friend who's a poet who would read and it was part of his work. I was like, mm-hmm. I hate you. Because mm-hmm. if I read, I feel desperately guilty for it not being a medical textbook.
Exactly. If I ask the question of what do you read to most doctors, they have a look that comes over their faces and they say journals like this. And it's almost like if they pick up a novel, they feel like they're cheating or something like that. It was very, very interesting through the years about how few will sit there and they say, well, you know, if I retire, then I would go read novels or I would go read books. But instead, it was always about being on the top of your game. It was always about knowing what was happening, what was going on. And I think that your writing also, though, comes from understanding the human spirit in that very short time in emergency medicine, because you need to do that quick connection. You need to do, and I think with your characters, you drew us in so quickly because it's almost like that assessing kind of a moment. Am I making sense? That you're...
Absolutely, except that it wasn't a short time in emergency medicine. It was 25 years.
Well, whatever I'm saying. What I'm saying is, you know, during your... It's a long day. It felt longer, I'm sure. But, you know, 25 years of doing that, though. But during that time, it's that constant assessing of people, that constant of... And also how you're going to deliver news, because you're also delivering news back to others. You're delivering into... Which is often not good news, because you don't usually go into the emergency room because it's something like, you know, small or things like that. So I just feel like that there are similarities in some ways between medicine and writing, though. Okay.
Yeah, probably. I think what has really driven me a lot of ways during when I write is that my experience in emergency medicine, you see a lot of the worst things. Mm-hmm. I think we're similar to cops and mm-hmm. cops and doctors really, especially emergency medicine doctors, really, we get along in a lot of ways. Just because for whatever reason, however you want to look at cops and doctors, we see a lot of terrible things. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard sometimes to stay positive or to feel, not to feel beaten down. Mm-hmm. And when I write, I don't want to pretend that these terrible things don't happen, mm-hmm. but I want to rise above them almost, find a way to put them into perspective. It's really hard, but that's what I'm trying to do in my stories is, you know, stuff happens, terrible things happen, but we can still find happiness. We can still be happy.
And you still feel like what will happen to Philip, because there are moments that things are terrible that are happening for him, and they're little glimpses of joy. And then there are terrible things that happen to him, but it's how you find joy during those times, how you find some, if it's not joy, it's peace. If you find some times of acceptance, you find times of whatever. And I found that that was, you know, something that I saw, even though he was in the most difficult of circumstances. So was this always the title, What Could Be Saved?
No. It was the short story was called The Driver. The book, when I sold it eventually, as it sort of metamorphosed, was called Eden.
Eden.
And part of the reason that I knew that was a working title, because it was a little too on the nose. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, they're in this house with a garden and a high wall, and they're, you know, they're ejected from their innocence. There's a lot that tracks with Eden. But part of the problem with it was, one, it's rather generic in a way. It's been used for a lot of things. And it didn't capture all of the book either. It really didn't. Mm-mm. It captured an earlier version of the book that didn't have the missing child. It captured some chapters, even some sections, but it was really hard to find a phrase that I thought encapsulated the whole book.
Mm-hmm. No, it definitely works. So the cover also, was this the cover right from the beginning?
Well, yes, because Atria is fantastic. The original design was very close to this, and I couldn't, they allowed me to comment, which is incredibly nice, because I loved it, but the original blue was a little too light.
Mm-hmm.
And the original font was a little too jaunty. Mm-hmm. And it gave the sense when I just looked at it, because I was fresh to it, you know, they showed it to me. And I thought, it looks like a fun book, like a funny book or a farce. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want someone to pick it up and be like, oh my God, you know, you're killing me. Because I think it's a pretty heavy book in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so we worked on, they listened to me. It was so nice. They really, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm not a designer, don't listen to me. But they went with the blue. We went back and forth on the blue. We ended up with a bright but darker blue. And then the font was actually, I talked to a friend of mine with whom I went to high school and college. She's a graphic designer. And she said, I think I know exactly the font you're looking for. And she recommended this font.
Wow.
And it was, because it looks like paint strokes.
It does.
Yeah, and all of this was driven by the team at Atria. If I had to design a cover, we would still not have a cover. So.
They're really hard to do. It's really hard to do a cover. And you know, this stands out on the shelf, too. I mean, when you're sitting and looking at this, it's really, I mean, look at it from afar. And a lot of times I put a book back here and you don't really see the book. But this is really popping and, you know, from there. I also listened to some of the audiobook, which Lisa Flanagan narrates. Have you listened at all yet?
I'm dying to hear that.
You're dying to hear. I heard a snippet. It's really good.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah.
I hear she's fantastic.
Yeah. It's really, really well done. Are you working on something now?
Thank you for asking. Yes, I am. It's a little hard because I had gotten about a third of the way through before COVID struck.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been stalled a little bit because I'm not sure it's supposed to be set in the near future. Mm-hmm. It was always supposed to be set in the near future, but now I have to figure out how far in the future after COVID and try to imagine what the ramifications are. Mm-hmm. It's more speculative fiction, I would say, mm-hmm. because it is in the future. It's not science fiction, but mm-hmm. it's speculative fiction. And so I'm just trying to, I don't want to write science fiction, although I like science fiction fine. I'm not trying to achieve that. But anyway, I'm trying to figure out what little things,
yeah,
what the world is, because I need to live in that world. When I tell writers when they're having a problem, I just say, well, I've said this so many times, just go there, just put yourself there and write it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are like, what are you saying to me? Put yourself there, what? But that's, so I'm trying to figure out what world I'm going to be in to mm-hmm. put myself there. But I have the book. I actually even know the end.
That's good. Right backwards. Right backwards. You know, it's really interesting because if you told us even a year ago now that people would not be in offices. I always say that if somebody took the plot for the pandemic and brought it to a publisher and said, let me just tell you, kids aren't going to go to school. People aren't going to leave their houses. You're not going to spend the holidays with anybody. No one's going to be working. Everybody's going to be remote. There's going to be this thing called Zoom, which no one knew what it was. Okay. All this stuff is going to happen. A publisher would say, take that back, pull back 50%. It's completely unrealistic. And I think what you're talking about right now is the world has shape-shifted so much. People aren't living in cities. They've moved home. They've moved to become digital nomads. They're doing all these different things. So to sort of picture where the world is going to end up at this point is, well, which of these things are people going to keep and which are they going to take away?
Exactly. I think there are going to be some fundamental things that will be changed forever. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some things we will get back. I'm just having a little trouble putting myself there because I'm so deep in this pandemic now with, I mean, I've been in this house for 11 months. Yes.
I go very few places. And when I leave the house, it's like, oh, I'm getting in the car. Okay, here is my one prediction, everybody. I'm telling you right now. There will be more car accidents because no one knows how to drive anymore. I will be driving down the highway and people will be driving so fast. I mean, roads that you normally would go quickly on, people are driving so much faster. And the other thing I'm noticing is even if you're around town, people just drive like, oh, I want to go now to go to the grocery store. Let me just make a turn. And I'm like, wait until everyone is back on the road because I look at the number of miles I've driven in the last year. I haven't done that since I was 17 years old, since I was 16 before I started driving. And that I think will change. I think that also for you, writing not in the coffee shop across from your sister, when you go back to that, what will that rhythm give you? Or is that such a different rhythm from where you've been for the last year? It's just going to be interesting to see what happens with people, you know?
Well, I think we're used to, as you say, the traffic, we're used to less traffic. We're used to being like less populous out in the world. Mm-hmm. Out in the world, we're not used to other people. What are you doing here? This is my road. Like it feels rather odd, but I hope that there are some good things that come out of all this terrible stuff. Mm-hmm. I really do. What I do like the fact that we've gotten so much better with remote.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We had the technology and we weren't using it. And I think we've gotten our mindsets in the right place. So
what I really love is I've been able to talk to more authors. I've been able to see many more events. I've been able to see many more. I mean, like, okay, if I was you would come into New York, we'd have gone and done that lunch, which means I would have left the office. I would have gone down and had a 2-hour lunch. I would have gone back. It would have been a 3-hour event. Whereas I got to see you online for an hour and it was lovely. It sounds crazy, but it was absolutely great. And we got to ask you questions and we got to do that back and forth. And I think that there's certain things that I'm actually loving. I will say that if you're out with a group of people, it is like we had my parents and my mom here for Christmas, and my mother-in-law here for Christmas. And afterwards, it was like exhausting because you hadn't done that much interpersonal conversation. Like even on Zoom, it's not the same thing. It's not the same as picking up cues around the room. No, it's not the same, you know?
It's so true.
I mean somebody gets the yellow box, you know they're talking.
That's all right. We're going to have to like develop little yellow frames we hold over our faces.
What we're doing. Yeah. And it's, I don't know. I just think that it's, but at the same time, it's such a delight for you to be able to share this book with readers at this point, because I think it's a book people are going to love. They're going to talk about. This is a book club book, everybody. This is something that you're going to want to be having book club discussions, and they can reach out to you via your website to have those discussions.
Yes. LisaSchwartz.com. It's hard to spell, but once you get it right, you got it.
Exactly.
It's I before E and there is no T. So it's LisaSchwartz.com. And there's a section on book clubs and you can just hit me up. I'm doing a book club tomorrow.
Yeah. And I think that that is something that, while it's remote, I think that people are going to be able to access many more authors doing this and be able to just, you know, Zoom all day long and be able to have conversations. But this is a book I heartily recommend, not only for readers to go and enjoy, but then enjoy and discuss with others, because there's so much to, like I said, like that onion of peeling this book apart. And there's so many different, there's so many chapters that are going to send you in so many different places. And I completely admire that for your writing. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much.
So, well, thank you for joining us today. I think I've covered everything in my extensive notes over here, including about like snakes, malaria, and dysentery. There we go. You know, it's like, I want to go to Thailand maybe. So maybe to the beach. So
we'll I think see it's better there. Than now than it was in 1972.
Okay. So there we'll go from there. Thank you so much for joining us. Much success to you.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm so touched that you enjoyed the book so much.
And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks so much. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from What Could Be Saved by Lisa O'Halloran-Schwartz, narrated by Lisa Flanagan, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from What Could Be Saved, narrated by Lisa Flanagan.
Caught in the act, said Sullivan, appearing at the top of the studio stairs. He stood there for a moment, slightly out of breath from the four-story climb. Not quite, said Laura. She was in the little kitchen area working the color from her hands using a rag dipped in mineral spirits. Her cleaned brushes lay in an exhausted regiment across the counter. Sullivan's nose wrinkled. All this technology and you can't open a window, he said. I'm going to find you dead in here one of these days. Where's your business sense? She said dryly as he crossed to the glass panel, set into the wall. My untimely demise would definitely drive prices up. Although how untimely would it be, really? 54 was young enough for people to murmur, so young, but not mean it. Old enough for youthful sins to have caught up. He tapped at the controls. A muted growl came from the back wall as motorized shades began to descend over the windows there. They stopped and reversed. The side lights blinked on and then off again, then the overhead lights on and off. Finally, a click overhead and a whir, and two of the high slanted skylights began to move. Sullivan stood with his head back, watching them lift away from the ceiling. A damp spring air blew in.
It is a good smell, though, he said, taking his hand down from the control panel. Means you've been working.
He crossed the room to stand in front of the easel.
Another ghost, I see.
His voice maddeningly neutral. Sullivan had been excited about the ghost pictures at the beginning. He'd given them a prime-time autumn opening in the New York space, had written lyrical catalog copy. Scraped canvases intrigue the viewer with muted, suggestive images like the residue of a dream. That had been 4 years ago.
Why are you here?
It came out more abruptly than she'd intended.
Because you don't answer your phone, he said. Or email. Or texts.
He bent close to scrutinize a section of the painting.
Someone called the gallery trying to reach you.
I think my phone is downstairs. Finding a clean place on the solvent wet rag, working it into the webbed crotch between two fingers, she nodded to the landline squatting on the counter.
You could have called me on that.
He shrugged.
It gave me an excuse to check on you.
That was what it had come to. Sullivan was 6 years younger than she was. At one point, he'd wanted to sleep with her and she'd considered it. He was funny and smart and good-looking, and she'd been feeling raggedy after Adam and wanting a boost, but had decided against it on principles of don't shit where you eat. Since then, apparently, Laura had edged over an invisible hill. Now Sullivan was checking on her as though she were his elderly aunt.
Also, I promised Kelsey, he added. She's the one who took the telephone calls.
Oh-ho, Laura said. Kelsey, the Washington Gallery's new front desk girl. Mid-20s, very pretty. Her manner toward Laura infused with that millennial you-go-girl faux-hardiness reserved for the elderly or otherwise pathetic.
It's been a whirlwind in here, Kelsey had told Laura when they met.
Laura, indulging an evil impulse, had gotten the girl to repeat herself, and Kelsey had obliged, speaking more slowly. There again was the space between the syllables, the unmistakable thud of the extra D. Kelsey was saying whirlwind, or possibly whirlwind. She was at least 20 years younger than Sullivan, but no one would blink if the two of them began an affair. Perhaps they already had.
"Apparently you've ignored 3 emails," said Sullivan.
He had his phone out now, was tapping and swiping through screens.
"The caller was very upset."
Laura imagined Kelsey's whimper.
"He yelled at me. He was awful."
"Here."
He held out the phone.
"Something about your brother. You don't have a brother, right?"
Laura stared at him, then put down the rag and reached to take the phone, ignoring his wince at her still painty hand. She read the brief message through once, twice. Then, holding it up before her, eyes on the screen, she walked over to the landline, took up the receiver, and dialed.
"Listen to this email," she said when Beatrice answered.
She cradled the receiver between ear and neck and read aloud. "I believe I have found your brother, Philip. Are you Laura Preston, born on 25 March 1965 to Robert and Genevieve Preston? If so, please reply. If you are not the correct Laura Preston, I am sorry for deranging you. Thank you, Claude Bossert."